It's Wednesday, October 15th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, do you want to know about every person tested for Ebola, every airport scare, false alarms and all? Are those news? I'm going to ask our panelists for their thoughts. The New York Times says it's time for the U.S. to end its trade embargo on Cuba, and it does it in Spanish. To whom exactly is the editorial board trying to reach with its message? And we'll talk about Laura Poitras' documentary on Edward Snowden screening this weekend at Ragtag. There's a lot more hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with Dr. Nancy Snyderman. You might remember last week, Professors Jamie Graber, Jim Flink, and I laid some pretty high compliments on the NBC medical editor. That's because she and her crew made it clear that they were going to self-quarantine for 21 days after freelancer Ashoka Mukbu tested positive for the Ebola virus. Snyderman said that she was staying in seclusion, taking her temperature several times a day, and was exceeding the Center for Disease Control's quarantine guidelines. Until, that is, she didn't. According to the Princeton Planet and TMZ, Snyderman went out last week to pick up some soup from her favorite restaurant. That led to a mandatory quarantine order from the New Jersey Health Department. Monday, Brian Williams read this statement from Snyderman on the NBC Nightly News.
Our chief medical editor, Dr. Nancy Snyderman, has been in the news herself these past few days. We spoke with Nancy earlier today, during which time she said, quote, while under voluntary quarantine guidelines, which called for our team to avoid public contact for 21 days, members of our group violated those guidelines and understand that our quarantine is now mandatory until 21 days have passed. We remain healthy and our temperatures are normal. As a health professional, I know that we have no symptoms and pose no risk to the public, but I am deeply sorry for the concerns this episode caused. We are thrilled that Ashoka is getting better, and our thoughts continue to be with the thousands affected by Ebola whose stories we all went to cover.
And it seems a once sympathetic public is now looking at Snyderman through a slightly different lens. Here's Rosie Perez on The View.
She went to go get food at a drive-thru. At a drive-thru, people. And I just thought that that was so irresponsible. Listen, whether she knows she's infected or not, you know, you just don't do that. You don't put fear into the public when you're a public figure. You just don't do that.
So last week, we were pretty vocal around this table in our praise for Snyderman, pointing out that she was going to talk the talk, she was going to walk the walk, she was doing everything. Personally, I feel a little bit foolish having heard what happened and having bought into it, having seen how demonstrative she was in talking about how she was going to be exceeding those guidelines. Now we find this out.
Well, first of all, I kind of sympathize with Rosie Perez's, you know, feelings about this, even though she was factually incorrect. It wasn't a drive-through. The car pulled up
in
front
of an omelet. She was sitting in the
parking lot. Yeah, right. But I have to say, first of all, that statement that NBC released, how lame is that statement? I mean, first of all, it sounds like it was completely vetted by PR and legal. There's never any acknowledgement that it was Snyderman herself who went out and broke the quarantine, although there's witnesses that said that she did it. It basically just went on to say that, well, we're sorry if anybody was concerned. Yeah, she probably didn't pose a threat, but she agreed to the quarantine and then she violated it. And I think that violates the public's trust.
Yeah, and in situations like this, if you're going to step out and you're going to say that you're going to do something, especially if you're with the media, you need to do it because others are going to be looking. I mean, we have a culture of gotcha journalism going on, and it's not just about at other people. It's also directed at us. So she really put not only herself, but also NBC in a very difficult situation.
So that aired on the Nightly News Monday evening. The initial reports about Snyderman being in the parking lot of this restaurant was coming out that this happened like Thursday. By late Friday night, it was out there. And at that point, the state of New Jersey had mandated this quarantine order. Did NBC or Nancy Snyderman wait too long, staying quiet till Monday evening?
Well, I don't know if they waited too long because, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, you're not going to get much play over the weekend. So waiting until Monday after all the, you know, usual sports and that sort of thing, where you're on a typical news day where people are going to be paying attention, was probably the right thing, right place and time to do it. But I think Mike is right. It's the way they did it, not actually mentioning that she was the one that broke the quarantine, which is what has some people up in arms.
I mean, if you're going to wait over the weekend, couldn't you come up with something better than that lame statement they came up with? And I have to also say, I mean, we often talk about just the images portrayed by journalists, especially network news people. Here we have this report in the Princeton Planet saying she pulled up in her black Mercedes and was wearing sunglasses and a ponytail to suggest she was trying to hide. It just shows the disconnect. It reinforces that stereotype that people have about how celebrity journalists are not like you and me, the people who watch them.
The other thing that sort of bothered me about this is that, okay, if you come back and you decide that you're going to do this sort of voluntary quarantine, why don't you just do it? There's really no reason to publicize it. You know, it's one of those things where you're trying to get, you know, some sort of publicity for doing something good and courageous. And of course, you know, we're going to make sure that we're on the high and mighty. There was really no need to do that.
And that's how this is really blown up in her face, I think, because she made a point of making it about her in the first place. We're coming back. I'm going to be exceeding the CDC guidelines. I'm going to be doing even more than what they say to make sure we're overly cautious and everybody's going to be okay. We're not exposing anyone to any threat. That's where she creates a problem.
I think that created a problem. I mean, think about all the other journalists who have been in West Africa covering this story. They aren't trying to do anything differently. They're probably being very cautious themselves about exposure and those sorts of things, but they're not publicizing it to the point where she did.
Some are saying that perhaps she should lose her job over this. What do you think?
Okay, now that's stretching a little bit. I'm not sure whether or not she should lose her job. However, I think that there should be some sort of punishment for violating it.
And my guess is there won't be any.
I don't think there will be either.
Well, the coverage of the Ebola outbreak is everywhere, and with the confirmation that Nina Pham and another nurse contracted the virus while treating Thomas Duncan in a Dallas hospital, there's a swath of news stories coming to light. The idea of nurses across the country who say they're not properly equipped or trained to treat Ebola patients, airport workers who are protesting requirements to screen passengers arriving from West African nations, and hospitals across the country testing patients who present with high fevers and other related symptoms. That happened this week in both Massachusetts and closer to home at the University of Kansas Medical Center in Kansas City, Kansas. The Associated Press has issued some guidelines on this, saying that it's not going to cover every single instance of somebody being tested so as not to create additional alarm. Mike, you told me before the show that maybe you don't necessarily agree with that.
No, I do agree with it in principle, and I agree that the media should be careful not to create a needless climate of fear. We talk about that all the time. And so, and I think there are instances perhaps where the media have done that, wittingly or otherwise. But I will say, especially if you look at that University of Kansas Medical Center story, the reason that the media reported on that in the first place is because the doctors there called an impromptu news conference because of rumors that were being spread by social media. That's what the doctor at the news conference said. And so I don't think that this story came out, that it was reported in Kansas City and elsewhere, that there might be a case because, you know, we just wanted to put any little rumor out there we could. A news conference was held to dispel the rumor. So I think that's a legitimate news story. I also think you pointed out some things. We at first wanted to believe that all the American medical system would never allow Ebola to spread. And yet we've seen instances of nurses complaining. We've had examples from Spain where healthcare workers there say the government shut down an isolation ward because of budget cuts. There's a lot of concern among the public that what the government tells us may not be the last word on our safety. So I think the media have to at least report those things.
I agree with you on that. I think the media should report those things. The problem that I have is that we're spending now all of a sudden, because there are cases in the West, here in the United States, in Europe, we're spending a lot of time covering those cases, and we're not talking about where the epicenter is in Western Africa. That's where the issue is. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I heard this morning, or somebody brought it to my attention, is that there've also been cases of it in Nigeria, but they've done a very good job of isolating those cases in certain areas so that it doesn't become a countrywide problem. And I think if we could probably focus in on what they're doing there and think about what we're doing here, right and wrong, we'd have a much clearer picture about what's happening outside of Liberia. But I also think we also need to go back into Liberia and look at what is causing the problem. Why can't they seem to be able to control it there? I mean, you see bits and pieces of the story, but now that we've sort of moved the story to the West, we've lost all connection to the epicenter of where the problem is right now.
No, I agree completely with that. And I mean, it's unseemly and unfortunate, if not unusual, mm-hmm. that American people and the American news media kind of ignore or downplay thousands of deaths already and many thousands more that are likely to occur. But boy, once we have one or two cases here, suddenly we've ramped up the coverage. But even if we're going to look at it through that selfish lens, we need to be doing more reporting about the epicenter, because we're not going to stem the spread of that disease in the U.S. until we lock it down where it's happening in Africa.
No, you're absolutely right. And we need to cover that, but also we need to cover what are the procedures here. One of the things that I was listening to this morning is that there are four centers right now that are qualified mm-hmm. to handle
right.
the major cases of Ebola. And now they're trying to figure out, well, what do we do for any hospital that happens to get a patient who comes in who may have it? Do we airlift them immediately there, or do we try to treat them at that place and send the mobile facilities there? How do we do that? So we really don't even have a handle as to how this is going to be taken care of here. And our coverage is wholly inadequate to even deal with that.
And a story I'm fascinated about, this first doctor, the aid doctor who came back and recovered from it, Brantley, they've used his blood to transfuse, I think, three of the people who've come back to the U.S.
He's been doing plasma donations
right.
over and over again.
So I'd like to hear a little bit more about what scientists might be doing, because he didn't have the right blood type to help Duncan, right? But what are scientists doing to try to take whatever is in his blood, if there's anything
the
there that helps?
The antibodies there at this point and begin to
others.
Develop
yeah.
some kind of a treatment
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's change the subject a bit and talk about an interesting editorial that showed up in the Sunday New York Times that called for an end of the trade embargo against Cuba. But in my decision to study French in grade school made it a little tough for me to read it, because the piece was published entirely in Spanish. I read a translation of the editorial, and you can see it both on our links blog and on the New York Times' site itself, both in English and Spanish, to get the full text. I want to ask you, having read it, because it didn't sound like anything we hadn't heard before, who's this editorial really trying to reach?
Well, I think it may have been trying to reach the Spanish language population mm-hmm. or the Latino or Cuban population, maybe in Florida, maybe in other parts of the country, to sort of get their reaction to what, like you said, something that's been talked about for years and years. Right. And it's not anything new. I mean, I'm really surprised that we're still sort of have this embargo going on, because the whole concept of Cuba and the embargo and the relationship within Florida, all that's changed over the course of several presidential cycles. So, why this is coming up now, I have no idea. But the way they did it, I thought was ingenious.
I don't know if it's targeted at Spanish-speaking population in this country, if it's targeted at the Cuban regime. It obviously was targeted ostensibly at the Obama administration, mm-hmm. at the president. I have to say, you know, I don't think that we can stipulate that maybe the embargo really is, if it ever was useful, it's not all that useful anymore.
Right.
But is the president going to do anything in the immediate future as a result of the New York Times editorial? I seriously no. doubt it. They're not naming a replacement for Eric Holder. They're not taking executive action no. on immigration because of the congressional elections right. and not wanting to hand more fuel for the Republicans who might take over the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was a window for President Obama to do something about Cuba in his first term, but that is definitely closed.
Okay, well, so this might not be the smoothest transition in history, but let's go from talking about Cuba to talking about North Korea. For weeks, there have been quiet rumblings in the media about the sudden disappearance of that country's leader, Kim Jong-un, and they only got louder this weekend when the 32-year-old dictator failed to show up Friday in an event to commemorate the creation of the Korean Workers' Party. There was speculation he'd fallen quite ill, having developed diabetes and gout. Others said perhaps there had been a political coup and he was no longer in power. Saturday Night Live even got in on the act with a few laughs during the show's cold open.
You of all people should never question me. Why did you go to South Korea when you knew that I forbid this?
It was a diplomatic mission, sir, as part of the Asian Games.
What? Why would you send anyone to the Asian Games when the world's greatest athlete is standing right in front of you? I have an Olympic medal in beach volleyball.
But, sir, you're limping.
What? Who said that? I told you. I broke my ankle while dunking over Michael Jordan. This is what happened. The movie Space Jam is about me. We all know this.
My apologies, dear leader. It's just people think you're out of touch.
How could I be out of touch when I have the same haircut as Brad Pitt in the movie Fury? I am sensing many of you doubt my strength. Perhaps a demonstration is in order. Quack Pumji, I want you to punch me as hard as you can.
Dear leader, I could never.
Punch me hard. I order you to punch me or die. Now everyone turn around.
That was in my heart. He punched me in the heart with an animal.
Monday, the mystery was put to rest. Maybe. The North Korean state media published photos of Kim Jong-un showing him walking with an entourage using a cane while reportedly visiting a new residential complex for scientists. What's not clear, though, is when these photos were taken. It's strange to us, at least here in the United States, to have a leader go completely out of sight for 40 days. And then it just becomes business as usual.
And, you know, the media and others love, you know, making fun at his expense. And, you know, I must say, I took a little bit of pleasure in reading some of the more obscure rumors. I mean, one of them had that he was having ankle surgery because he was wearing platform shoes to make him look taller, and because he was too fat because he was eating too many buttercreams or cheese or whatever it was. But I have to say, and we don't know what really is going on there, I don't think.
And I don't think we're ever going to.
But he may be crazy, he may be lazy, he may be fat, but the guy has one of the largest armies in the world, he has nuclear weapons, and he's not afraid to at least threaten to use them. So we need to take this guy seriously, too.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those Where's Waldo stories, you know. It's
and there were actually some parody photo galleries out there that had Waldo in them.
Absolutely right. But I think Mike brings up a good point, is that when you have a leader of a country that has that kind of power that goes, you know, pretty much goes missing for that long of a period of time, you know, people begin to worry. And I'm pretty sure that there were governments across the world that were trying to figure out what's going on here. So, I mean, there is some seriousness to it. And now that he's reemerged, we can at least reportedly reemerge, we can sort of look back at it in a humorous way.
Well, and even some of the coverage of his disappearance and then reemergence from friendly nations, taking a look at some of the coverage from CCTV, from Chinese media, which has a very close relationship with the North Koreans. Again, no real, it was not at all clear what was going on there. It was just, we don't know where he is.
It's one of the most isolated, locked down police states in the world. And so it's hard for real information to emerge.
And to me, that's the interesting, the most interesting thing about North Korea generally is that in today's world with social media and what's going on in China right now and in Hong Kong and the images that you're seeing out of that and the stories that you're seeing out of that, how you can still have a country like Cuba we were talking mm-hmm. about and North Korea where it's isolated. You don't get information out of those countries unless the government wants you to get it. And it's amazing that could happen in the 21st century.
Okay, well, in our next topic, a film that screened Friday in New York, and Sunday it's going to screen here in Columbia. Laura Poitras's Citizen 4.
So I don't know anything about you.
Okay. I work for...
Sorry, I don't know your name.
Oh, sorry. My name is Edward Snowden. I go by Ed. Edward Joseph Snowden's the full name.
The film goes into the week NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden spent in a Hong Kong hotel room, spilling the details of state-sponsored surveillance. A bunch of reviews came out following last week's initial screening in New York, and they're all glowing, predicting a possible Oscar for Best Documentary. this is a film many have been waiting a year and a half to see, to go inside that hotel room, hear some of those conversations between Edward Snowden and the Guardian reporters.
Yeah, and I'm unfortunately not going to get to see it this weekend here in Columbia, but I am looking forward to seeing it. And I think people should definitely go watch this movie. There's some breaking news that kind of came out of the documentary. One, that Snowden's girlfriend
is now
left behind in Hawaii is now living with him in Russia. There was another story that said that apparently a second whistleblower has come forward to Glenn Greenwald and the folks at The Interceptor as a result of what's gone on with Snowden. So that's pretty interesting to see what's going to develop there. There's news that Greenwald and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange are basically fighting over the legacy of Edward Snowden. So those are all kind of interesting things. But I'm not sure that's the most interesting thing that's going to come out of this documentary. I mean, reading some of those reviews, it's really amazing to hear what Poitras has gone through and in some ways how her exile in Berlin kind of parallels the exile that Snowden's facing in Russia.
I mean, I think it's one of those things where you have governments, the governments that are being impacted by this, and clearly the United States, Great Britain, and others, who have really gone out and orchestrated these exiles. I mean, they have pretty much tried to create this narrative that this is not whistleblowing as we know it. These are people who have put others in danger, who have created this sort of mass use of secrets to thwart what these governments have been doing to fight the war on terror. And they've crafted it in a way that has sort of isolated them. And it'll be interesting to see how this film plays out among the populace when they get a chance to see it.
Yeah, one of the things, there's a great piece in The New Yorker, which you've posted on our blog, and I would really encourage people to read that, basically looking at how Laura Poitras made the film. And it's really eerie to me how, I mean, she is in Berlin because she was constantly being harassed, stopped in airports when she would fly in or out of the country. And so she is there in Berlin right now, finished up the film. Snowden is in Russia, and both of them say how much they would like to come back to the U.S., which is a little different from some of these other whistleblowers and, you know, crypto anarchists and other folks that are out there.
Well, I'm going to be going Sunday. I'm looking forward to seeing the whole thing.
Yeah, to me, it's one of those things where I think the governments themselves are really trying to downplay this film that's coming out, because I think they're concerned that something new may come out, or now that the story has sort of lost its legs, that it's going to reemerge
again. Or that perhaps people will see it in a different light when seeing exactly how it unfolded, or without maybe the filter of a reporter's lens, as opposed to just watching the conversation as it happens.
Well, in fact, what kind of example does he set? As I say, one of the things that comes out in the movie is that apparently there is another source now in the intelligence community that's leaked information about our drone program and about who's on the Obama administration watch list, terrorism watch list. So there may be a lot more information that could come out as a result of people seeing and honoring what Edward Snowden has done.
Well, the timing here is probably pretty coincidental, but this week, New York Times investigative reporter James Risens is digging in his heels, fighting the Obama administration's crackdown on leaks. Days before his book, Pay Any Price, hit shelves, federal prosecutors hinted they still intend to subpoena him in the case of former CIA agent Jeffrey Sterling. Sterling is accused of being the anonymous source in Risen's first book that Risen says he won't actually divulge that source. That trial is expected to begin in January, and Risen has said he will go to prison before divulging the name of that source.
I think this is one of those instances, this goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago with Eric Snowden, where you have the government is basically saying, look, we're going to challenge this notion that reporters have a right to maintain the secrecy of their sources. And we're going to challenge that. We're going to fight it in court. We're going to throw you in jail. We're going to threaten to throw you in jail. And you know, a lot of people are saying that this is going to be, this may be one of the legacies of the Obama administration and its relationship with the press. But I think this goes even further back than that. I mean, I think he's taken it to a level that I think George W. Bush was also headed in that same direction. So I just find it very eerie for journalists in today's age to have to deal with these issues. I mean, it's amazing.
And even though, you know, the Obama administration and the Justice Department did say they were going to come up with new guidelines, did come up with new guidelines about whether or not to prosecute reporters, they're still not saying whether or not they're going to subpoena Risen, and they very well might. And if they do and he doesn't give out the source, he could still go to jail. So, I mean, I think this is a really fascinating story. And I would suggest, again, you've got a link to the 60 Minutes piece on this from past weekend from Leslie Stahl. And it's really an amazing look at how, in fact, even the New York Times really didn't provide Risen the cover he needed. They didn't publish his story until he threatened to come out with a book and name the Times as, and shame the Times in the process before they released his story.
I think that the larger point about all of this is that the media, because of it, the fragmentation of it, does not have the same kind of power and authority among the populace that it once did. Because back during the Watergate time period, and even going back to the Pentagon Papers, there was this public trust that was there. And in order for the government to be able to do this, I mean, they had to have the government, I mean, the public's backing. They didn't have it then. Now they do. I think the public is willing to let these things happen because the media doesn't have that same kind of, the public doesn't have that same confidence in the media. But for them to be able to trust it to do the right thing.
Okay. Well, before we leave you today, a quick chat about another sign of our changing times. Do either of you play chess?
No.
Yeah. Well, my dad tried to teach me several times when I was a kid, and I never quite caught on. Well, the New York Times isn't seeing too many people playing anymore either. And as of this weekend, it stopped its weekly chess column after more than half a century. You think anybody's going to notice?
I don't know. I mean, in the fact, I saw some reporting that suggested they might not end it after all.
And that it might come back online because there has been.
There is a Missouri connection, by the way.
There is.
Rex Sinkfield, who's the billionaire who supports all these conservative and libertarian causes here in Missouri, he sponsors one of the biggest world competitions of chess players in St. Louis. It happened just about a month and a half ago. And so that's a big... he's a big player in whether or not chess is going to be revitalized among high school
kids.
Nice
pun there.
That's very interesting. I mean, but you've seen newspapers cut back on a lot of things. So in some ways, I'm not surprised. I hope that if they do keep it, that they do keep it online so that it still has somewhat of a connection to what the New York Times does.
So you think the people, though, that would be most interested in the chess column would be the ones finding it online?
I think they would. They're going to go online.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. The conversation continues. You can read more about the topics we've talked about today on our links blog. That's on the KBIA website at kbia.org. It's under the programs tab. You can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Austin Federa for handling the audio. Kendrisa Cockrell and Hope Kerwin are our associate producers. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.